in the world did Jesus ever expect to get any followers for his movement saying stuff like that? Seriously, if you're going to be my disciple, you got to hate your mother and your father. You got to hate your spouse, your children, and even your life. You would flock to that, wouldn't you? Well, it's interesting that the word that gets translated hate, the Greek word miseo, does not imply any kind of hostility. It doesn't imply any kind of anger. What is being communicated here really is not anything at all about hating, but it is about setting priorities. If you don't consider my way above the way that is expected for you by your family, by society, then you're not worthy to be my disciple. And Jesus lives that out, right? He didn't hate his family. At the end of the Gospel of John, he puts his mother, Mary, into the care of his disciple, John, right? Even his chosen family, his circle of disciples, who don't get it the whole time they're with him, who ultimately desert him, he still cares for them. He still makes sure they have what they need, and he continues to work with them. But what he doesn't do is let them set his agenda. They expect him to go into Jerusalem and set up a kingdom like King David. They expect him to come in and throw out the Romans and replace them with a different kind of political regime, and he knows that's not going to work. He doesn't hate them, but he doesn't let that vision of his calling dominate. Instead, he knows from early on that when he goes to Jerusalem, instead of throwing the Romans out, he is going to submit himself to Roman power. And he, instead of defeating them, is going to be tortured by them and crucified by them. And he does not let the opinion of his chosen family of disciples dissuade him. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about living out your calling from God, even when your family members don't understand it or disagree with it. Even when the people within your church or denomination don't understand it or disagree with it. Those folks who marched for civil rights as early as the late 1940s and into the 50s and into the 60s, many of their families disagreed with the stands they took, both black and white marchers. And yet they felt called to live out their understanding of who God was calling them to be. Today, for those of us who stand with LGBTQ people, we are often not understood by other family members, by others in our own denomination. And yet you can't let the expectation of even your closest friends determine what your calling from God is or can be. For those who work among the homeless, for those who work among those who live on the margins, for those who work with those who are struggling with addiction, often their family members would just as soon they did something else. But they will not let their family members' opinion of what they ought to do stand in the way of their calling from God. That's what Jesus is talking about. He preaches a gospel of love. Hate has no place in it. But the gospel of love does not mean that you are ever dissuaded from who God has called you to be and what God has called you to do by the opinion of others. Ever. I wish I could tell you that I had done that. I remember a number of years ago, Sarah, our daughter, was about first grade. Lizzie would have been about four. I remember after dinner one night, Sarah said, "Daddy, would you do something with me? I don't remember, play a game, whatever." And I said, "I'm sorry, darling, I've got a meeting." I always had meetings. I'm a pastor. She said, "Daddy, I hate meetings." I said, "I do too, darling." But you see, that was not putting Jesus before my family. That was putting work before my family, and that is not the same thing. I don't think I can claim any credit. I don't know of a single time that I have put Jesus before my family. But too many times, and this is confession, I have put work before my family. I wish I could offer a better witness. Jesus goes on to talk about counting the cost. He gives two examples. The first is someone who's going to build a building. They have to know something about what it's going to cost them to build that building. It doesn't just apply to building buildings. It applies to renovating historic churches, too. We're in the middle of that. And some people who are a lot smarter than I am came up with a figure about what we would need to do the work that we needed to do to bring this building to, how shall I say this? At least a beginning of a 21st century condition. We had original wiring in this sanctuary, okay? Is that a scary thought or what? We won't after this. We are going to have some changes, but they sat down and they itemized every cost. Now, with changing in construction and such, it's costing more than we thought it would. I think all construction projects do. But somebody counted the cost before we got into it. That's what Jesus is talking about. Second example is that if you're a king and you go to war, you count the cost. Is their army larger than your army? What kind of devastation will happen to your people, to your soldiers? That may happen, but quite frankly, in my lifetime, there has never been a war that I truly believe the cost has been counted before we entered into it. Not the true cost. Not the cost of those who come back injured in body, mind, and spirit and need to be cared for. But by that time, we have lost all the excitement of going to war and are unwilling to care for them. You see, it's hard to count the cost because, quite frankly, when you enter into a project, you may not know what it's going to cost. In fact, you almost never do know. We had some idea here, but we've had to revise that idea over time about what it would cost to renovate this building. There were examples in Jesus' time, just like there are examples now, of buildings that got started and never got finished. There were wars fought in his time, just like there have been wars in our lifetime, where the cost was not truly counted. In truth, when I took my ordination vows, I had no idea what was going to be required. I really didn't. When you got married, huh? You had no idea what you were promising, did you? You thought you did. We can never truly know the cost. But there is one thing that we can count on, and that is that God's love weaves through all of this. Okay? Now, there's a second thing that Jesus says that is equally radical to this idea of rejecting your family's ideas about who you should be. That is, you cannot be my follower unless you give up all your possessions. I haven't done that. And in fact, Jesus didn't do that either. He still had outer garments and inner garments that he wore. He still had enough to eat. He had loaves and fish, not just to share with his disciples, but to share with others. I think what Jesus is talking about here is what the Buddhists call non-attachment. Recognizing that the people who come into our lives and the things that come into our lives are not our possessions. We do not own a single thing. We certainly don't own another person. How many things you think you're going to get in the casket with you? You see, ultimately, we are going to give up all our possessions, whether we want to or not. Maybe Jesus is preparing his disciples to live a life of non-attachment, where the one important thing, whether you have a lot or have a little, is that you know that the love of God streams through all of it. Probably the perfect example is Holy Communion. None of you possess this bread, this juice. They're not our possessions either. They're gifts of God. You come and you receive. You who receive it don't own it. We who give it don't own it. It's not our dinner. It's not our invitation. These are not our elements. They all belong to Jesus. And yet we believe as Christians that God's love is communicated through that, and we are nourished by gifts we have received, something we cannot earn or deserve or ever possess. We don't possess our spouse. We don't possess our children. They are given to us in trust. We don't even possess the things we claim to own. They are given to us in trust. And as Gordon Pierman said beautifully last week in that wonderful workshop that he did for us, we need to learn to hold it with open hands, because none of it is ours. The one thing that lasts, the one thing that will survive death, is the love of God. While Jesus' disciples were preparing for a political revolution and a new regime, Jesus was preparing to give himself over to the old regime, to allow them to do the worst that they could possibly imagine. And believe me, the Romans could imagine terrible ways to torture and kill people. To give himself over to that, trusting that God's love would work through it. And sure enough, it did. Sure enough, it did. He refused to give in to the opinions of his family, the opinions of his chosen family, his disciples, and the single-minded thing that he knew to do was the thing God had called him to do. And that's the only reason we're here today. He knew that once he got on that cross, he would be stripped and beaten. He had no possessions whatsoever. He was crucified naked. It was another way of humiliating you. He had literally nothing. He showed us what that's like. He had to be placed in a borrowed tomb. He didn't even have a place for the body to be laid. And yet, through all of that, God's love was at work, just like God's love is at work in and through us, just like God's love is at work in and through these elements today. So I invite you to come a little bit later. Chris will say the prayer of great thanksgiving. He will invite you to come at that point. But I invite you to come looking for that calling from God that is not dependent on the opinions of others, no matter how close they are to you. I invite you to come recognizing that everything else in your life is exactly like these elements, a gift of God and something that God's love can be communicated through. That is the good news, my friends. What Jesus is preaching is the opposite of the prosperity gospel. Following Jesus will not make you healthy, wealthy, and wise. It may make you wise, but not smart in the ways of the world. That's a lie. And we all know it's a lie. But sometimes we buy it because it's packaged so well. Jesus is saying, no, when you come and you follow me, you choose the way of the cross. And you never know where God is going to lead you. And it probably won't be the place that your parents want or your brothers and sisters want, or even your closest friends want, but it will be the place God wants, and God will move in and through you. And God's love that even survives death, something we cannot possess, but that surrounds us throughout life, in death and beyond death, will be with us. Thanks be to God.